We have, left two volumes on the table, at the entrance. They were studies that, were done at the Miller Center, of which, for which copies are available. One of the Office of Chief Justice, and the other of the President, the Attorney General, and the Department of Justice. We thought in connection with discussions today and future interest, we'd like to have anyone who wished, obtain copies of these books. They are for your use, and they are free, one of the few free things in this world. Dr. Ernst Benda is widely respected in this country and in Europe as both a theorist and a practitioner in the law. He was educated in the Kant Symposium in Berlin. He holds law degrees from the University of Berlin and the University of Wisconsin. He has been from 1971 to 1983 President of the Federal Constitutional Court. He is a Christian Democrat who served from 1957 to 71 as a member of the Bundestag, from 1967 to 1970 as State Secretary of the Interior, from 1971 to 1975 as Minister of the Interior. He is a professor of law at the University of Freiburg in Germany, and has been in this country for a brief visit and lectures and discussions and meetings. We feel enormously privileged that in that busy schedule he's found time to visit us and to speak on the influence of the American Constitution on the German Constitution, political practice in Germany. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, sir. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have been invited to be here for a short time and, in fact, talk about the subject, the influence of the American Constitution on Germany. I had to prepare myself on rather short notice. It was all my fault because I had two long vacations this year and I returned only perhaps a week before I had to leave again for the United States. I had to prepare, I don't recall how many formal lectures for this country in less than 1 week. So please apologize me. I say this only because I have the text for you and I hand it over to you. I had, in fact, to type it myself. I didn't have the time to go to Freiburg. I still live in Karlsruhe, which is the seat of the Constitution Court. I didn't have time to go to Freiburg and I decided to type it myself. It doesn't look bad if you. I'm not sure whether every one of you can type as much as I can. I learned it during the war in the German Navy because I was a wireless operator. I'm not going into this story, but in order to have this to have this code machine, you had to know how to typewrite. So I got some useful experience in this respect during this time. Now I turn to my subject and I start with a quote. If I quote something, I will attribute it to the respective source. I start with a quote. Let us follow the example of the United States and we will earn the most marvelous food. Give us this keystone for our constitution, it would make freedom secure, it would make German unity possible. These words, which Carl Friedrich believed to be touching in its optimism, came from Professor Mittermeier of Heidelberg University in the year of 1849, when the Frankfurt Constitutional Assembly debated the adoption of the American system of judicial review as a constitution of Frankfurt, which unhappily never went into force. Mittermeier at this time added that, quote again, the Constitution owes its life, its strength, the certainty of its provisions in detail to the Supreme Court, referring, of course, to the American Constitution and the American Supreme Court. The Frankfurt Assembly followed Mittermeier's appeal providing for a Reichsgericht, which was, among other tasks, to act on claims of unconstitutionality of state acts. Since, as I already mentioned, the Frankfurt Constitution never went into force, and its very modern ideas in some other fields also have been largely forgotten for a long time, and nothing came out of it. Exactly 100 years later, in the German Basic Law of 1949, the idea of judicial review finally won. Compared with 200 years of the American Constitution, a period of less than 40 years is of course a very short time, but it's safe to say that the principles of constitutionalism are today firmly rooted in German political and legal thinking, and more important, in the reality of our political life. The strong influence of American constitutionalism on German political and legal theory, and its impact in particular on the Grundgesetz, Basic Law of 1949, in the fields of federalism and, in my view, more important, in the field of judicial review, have been rightly pointed out, in particular by Carl Friedrich in its book The Impact of American Constitutionalism Abroad, published in 1967, one of the most excellent books on this subject, dealing not only with influence on Germany, but all countries in which any of this influence might be seen. And there have been quite a few other American-German writers who discuss this question. No state, quoting again, no state is more fitting to be sought over for a statesman than the United States, a miracle of our time, wrote Robert von Mohl already in 1824. This applies even today, in particular in the field of judicial review, a comparative study of the jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court and the German Federal Constitutional Court proves many similarities in the legal approach, the methods of decision, and the closely related underlying values. At the same time, however, important differences remain both in the political structure of both countries and in the concrete answers to constitutional questions. I'm not going into any detail for time reasons of the time limit, but I'm perfectly willing to discuss this in detail in the discussion if you want me to. Now, the Federal Republic of Germany is, of course, but one example of a country the constitutional development of which has been influenced by the United States Constitution. I happened to read the, in my opinion, excellent and remarkable special issue of July 6, 1987 of Time magazine, which focused on the 200 years of the United States Constitution. In this issue, the magazine discussed the international impact of the United States Constitution, calling it a gift to all nations. And I quote the summary in this one of these articles: of the 170 countries that exist today, more than 160 have written charters modeled directly or indirectly on the United States version. Now this is true, but one should add on the other hand that the principal idea of government of the people, by the people and for the people, to quote the familiar phrase of the Gettysburg Address, may be proclaimed in most or even all of these 160 constitutions. But the political reality is quite different. By another recent count, which did not appear in Time magazine, less than 30 of the United Nations member countries, roughly 170, maybe 175 or 180 by now, can rightly be called democracies, or countries in which the rule of law prevails. In this context, I would tend to believe that the existence of a written constitution in itself certainly does not guarantee its influence on the political reality. While on one hand, Great Britain, lacking any written constitutional document at all, certainly lives up to the high standards of government by the people, which are at the center of American constitutional ideas, many other countries have beautifully written constitutions full of promises, endlessly proclaiming democracy, sometimes even doubling the term, with the term people's democracy, which is a way to say the same thing twice. But in reality, they are more or less totalitarian states. It is my conclusion, therefore, that not the mere existence of a constitution, but its status in legal theory, in practice, and above all in the political reality, indicates the principal difference between constitutionalism on one hand and government by a one-man ruler, an oligarchy, a military dictatorship, or any other form of government by force on the other. But even as we still have to deplore the slow progress of democracy and the principles of constitutionalism in many parts of the world, I believe we have reason to be hopeful. Only recently, the development in countries like the Philippines, Haiti, or South Korea seem to indicate that these ideals can be stopped for some time, but they will never die. And they have always been connected with the question of constitution making in these countries I mentioned too. Even in the Eastern European countries, the time has come for reforms of the system of government which prove to be unable to cope with the problems of our time. This includes even the Soviet Union, even though, in my opinion, our optimism should still be a guarded one. At the same time, and strangely enough, in the Western democracies there has been much discussion in my country too about what some people call the ungovernability of by the traditional constitutional mechanisms. While it has been said that democratic governments and elected parliaments are ill-equipped to answer the complex question of highly industrialized societies, it should be noted that the slow, cumbersome, sometimes painful, gradual progress of decision-making at least guarantees, or at least makes possible, to discuss all the alternatives, to weigh them, and to compare the risks involved with the chances, while in a closed society, the richness of competing ideas furnished by conflicting political and philosophical groups and by the influence of public opinion is restricted to the necessarily narrowed outlook of a handful of leaders. Therefore, they are guided by their personal convictions, by party ideology, and are generally shut off from the opinions of others. Their decisions may come swiftly, but they lack the challenge of alternatives. The cautious approach to complex problems is, as a rule, the better way to answer the difficult, complex, and often dangerous problems of a modern society. Now, any constitution which is more than just a collection of empty promises or of government propaganda, but which is the supreme law of the land, guiding and limiting all state activities, has to adapt to the particular social, economic, and political conditions and to the changing times. Therefore, as Justice Louis Brandeis said about the United States Constitution, it is, quoting him, not a straitjacket, but a living organism, which means that it is able to grow, to expand, and to adapt to new circumstances. The example of a constitution proving this ability over a period of 200 years is, for me, the greatest part of the gift the United States have given to the other nations. The article in Time I mentioned quotes Professor Magnet of the University of Ottawa in Canada. America has been and remains the great constitutional laboratory for the entire world. While realizing that it is often claimed that a constitution created in a rural society 2 centuries ago is unable to answer the problem of a global power in the age of the outgoing 20th century, and in particular the concept of a presidential system modeled to fit George Washington's personality, is under heavy and, in my opinion, not entirely unfounded criticism. I still believe that the principle of continuity of a constitution is much better than the practice of some other countries, including my own, to have a new constitution every few years. Jefferson, however, said that every 20 years a new generation should have its own new constitution to meet current needs. Of course, current needs have to be met. The idea of what has been called original intent, the idea popular with some legal scholars, and in particular it seems to be to some members of the present government of the United States, would consequently transfer a main task of the Constitution to the political process, which means in effect to minimize or even to destroy the very idea of constitutionalism. In my personal opinion, this would be a very high price to pay, and I would be very reluctant to pay this price. In this year of the bicentennial, the world has every reason to watch with fascination and respect, sometimes with a bit of confusion too, this great constitutional laboratory. Not every experiment conducted may succeed. As the questions and problems of the times change, the Constitution, being a living organism, adapts to them, sometimes slowly or with difficulties. The idea of judicial review, which is one of the most important instruments to allow for adaptation and for change, may in itself, from time to time, gain a different meaning. This too is part of the continuing process of adaptation. The principle, however, stands, and it is perhaps the most important part of the concept of constitutionalism. It is also the part of the American constitutional system which probably had the greatest impact on the constitutional development in other parts of the world, and in particular in my own country. I refer again to Carl Friedrich and his book. In this, he rightly distinguishes 3 periods in which this influence was clearly different. First, quoting him, the early period of general enthusiasm after the adoption of the Constitution. Second, a middle period highlighted by the Constitution making of 1848 or the time around it. And third, the period after the 2 World Wars, in particular after 1945. I'm going to discuss these 3 stages only very briefly. In the time after the Revolution and the adoption of the Constitution, there was a very widespread feeling in Europe that the New Age, which had started with the French Revolution and which was the beginning of the end of absolute monarchy, called in the first place for written documents, written constitutions restricting the rights of the rulers and guaranteeing individual liberties. Some of the first written constitutions appeared not at all much later than the United States Constitution. For instance, some of the southern German states in the time shortly after the turn of the century, in particular after 1813, the War of Liberation. In general, it was not before the let's say the year of 1848 that most constitutions were established. The example of the United States was closely observed, but it was not copied. While many of the political thinkers of this time admired the successful American experiment, they really knew very little about it. America, of course, was a faraway land in which the dreams of all the European Democrats and Republicans became reality. The new republic owed much to the old continent, which provided many of the political and philosophical ideas underlying the United States Constitution. In Europe, for a long time, it seemed impossible to translate these ideas into a reality, while the completely different and unique conditions existing on the new continent could not just be copied. Again, quoting Carl Friedrich, and he quotes Goethe's celebrated exclamation, America, du hast es besser. America, you are much better off. And this, quoting Friedrich, poetically expressed a widespread feeling that America was too different to serve as a monarch, that its lack of monarchy, of feudal classes, its wide open frontier, that all these and the variegated population from many lands made the American experiment both exciting and unique, but inimitable. That's the end of the quote. In this sense, the American dream, the European view, remained a dream, a romantic notion responding to the desires of many of the best of the European thinkers. And this, in my impression, missed the most important aspect, is that a dream can be turned into reality. Quoting this famous saying of Theodor Herzl, reflecting on Zionism, wenn man daran glaubt, es ist kein Märchen. If you believe in it, it's not a fairy tale. This is a most important point. And this point, I believe, was missed at this time in Europe, including my own country. Now, this attitude changed completely when in the middle of the 19th century, in particular during the revolutionary movement, I barely made it, but I made it, of the years around 1848, the old European order underwent great changes corresponding with the beginning of the great industrial revolution. The rule and feudal societies gradually gave way to a new order. The principle of absolute monarchy was no longer accepted. The idea of a written constitution limiting the power of the rulers was widely accepted. During this time, the American example had a very great impact on the constitutional discussions and struggles in Europe. Now the whole development turned just around completely, I believe. Quite and completely, just more or less the opposite from what I mentioned as at least my impression of the time at the beginning of the 19th century. The United States, in the European impression, had proved during half a century that the model could and did work. But this was true for the time before the Civil War. But the Civil War, and Friedrich notes this too, put an end to the largely uncritical admiration of American constitutionalism. The people over here seem to have some major difficulties. While most of the new Latin American states copied the Constitution of the United States, including in particular the presidential system, in Europe, the key institution of the presidency was rejected because it appears to be too similar to the monarchy which European constitutionalism wanted to eliminate. Most European constitutions, even today, prefer the parliamentary system. The American influence at this time was and still is much stronger in the field of federalism, but this had an long European tradition, being much older than the American tradition. And to say this again, in particular, the idea of having fundamental rights and of judicial review appealed to the European constitution makers. This was quite clear, as I mentioned in the beginning, in the Constitutional Assembly at Frankfurt in 1848 and 1849. Again, I refer to Professor Mittermeier, one of the members of this assembly, he stressed the fact that the United States Constitution guarantees the citizens' rights against legislation. He urged to follow this example as a, to quote him, the finest ornament of the United States Constitution. He pointed to the role of the Supreme Court. He expressly rejected any doubts on whether judges are able to answer questions arising out of public policy. If such men are rightly selected, and in the United States they are, he said, which is leading up to the present discussions, and they can make the most wonderful decisions. They deal with cases, not with generalities, and they can determine whether a law is in accord with the Constitution. In my view, this being said in the years 1848-89, this may be a too romantic view of the American constitutional system of this time. In the first place, one has to consider that the American Constitution itself does not provide for judicial review in the sense developed by the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison, but this was a couple of years later, in 1803. In the field of civil rights, now the time they had in Frankfurt this romantic notion, it was roughly the time of the Dred Scott decision, and it was a couple of years before the 14th Amendment, which marked the beginning of any substantial fundamental rights jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court. Therefore, one might say that while in the first period of the 19th century, Europeans admired the American ideals but considered them to be too unrealistic, at least under European conditions, in this later period, the ideas and the ideals finally proved to be so attractive that the less than perfect reality was no argument against them, if the reality was at all noticed. So in this sense, it was just the opposite situation from the situation about half a century ago. One might even say that the European advocates of adopting the American system of judicial review and of civil rights did not draw upon any real historical experience, but rather took a development for granted which in the United States was yet to come. In a sense, they took the American dream more serious than the Americans themselves at this time. It may be another and highly fascinating story to explore to what extent this could have contributed to the later developments in the United States, which only gradually and slowly turns the dream into reality. Now, obviously, the impact of the American Constitution was much more direct when after the end of the Second World War, in the defeated and occupied countries, new and democratic system of government were to be established. This is particularly true in the case of the new constitution of Japan. I had a chance to listen to Dean Isao Sato of the Faculty of Law of Tokai University during a symposium of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. in May of this year, and at this symposium, he pointed out that the constitution, the Japanese that is, was drafted in February 1946 by American lawyers in uniform and their staff. Only at a later time were Japanese scholars allowed even to participate in the discussions. American constitution documents were widely used and in some parts more or less copied in the new constitution. The preamble of the Japanese constitution starts with the phrase, quote, "We, the Japanese people, to secure for ourselves and our posterity the blessing of liberty, do establish this constitution." Now, it's very familiar to anyone of you. This is almost exactly copies the preamble of the United States Constitution. Article 13 of the Japan Constitution confirms the people's right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, repeating the famous words in the Declaration of Independence. I could give you quite a few other examples. Apart from these and many other phrases, which will sound very familiar to any American who knows his constitution or other constitutional documents, many American ideas and institutions are recognized in the Constitution of Japan, including the principle of popular sovereignty, the principle of separation of powers, the fundamental human rights, and the establishment of the principle of judicial review. Clearly, the American lawyers working on the new Japanese constitution tried to translate as much as possible under the quite different conditions prevailing in the Japanese society American constitutional thinking and to form the new system according to what they believed should and could work there too. I discuss this faraway example to show you the principal alternatives which exists at this time. This, in my opinion, is probably not the best way to build a constitution which, above all, needs the general consensus of the country's citizens on principal values which should guide the political and social development. Of course, I'm not in a position to judge whether the Japanese experiment will be successful in the long run. Professor Sato claimed that the great majority of the Japanese people strongly supports the Japanese Constitution of 1947. He also mentioned some government leaders, as he quoted them, who tried to change the Constitution. So there seems to be somewhat of a debate about this question. Of course, at least no effort has been made to transfer the American presidential system to the Japanese constitution, probably because the special role of the emperor prevented this. It's quite a different concept to have a parliamentary system following the European tradition or to have the United States presidential system. And the current debate and political struggle going on right now in South Korea shows the potentially explosive character of this particular question, which is much more than a mere technicality. In his guidelines to the Japanese Prime Minister in October 1945, immediately after the end of the war, General MacArthur stressed that, quote, in fulfillment of the Potsdam Declaration, the traditional social order under which the Japanese people have been for centuries subordinated should be reformed. This requires, as a matter of course, the liberalization of the constitution. Now this poses a very ambitious task and, in my mind, a principal constitutional question. Should a constitution reflect the established social and political order? Or is it an instrument to reform the traditional order? The unique success story of Japan in many fields certainly owes much to the particular and perhaps also unique ability of the Japanese to adapt to foreign influence, which would not work this way in Europe. To accept reality and to reform a very old society to the needs of modern times. And still, to me, it's doubtful that the Japanese model of directly imposing constitutional ideas of a foreign country would work anywhere else, and only the future will tell whether it works in this country. Now I turn to the story of his German constitution. It's quite a different story. First of all, contrary to the situation in Japan, Germany in its western part, not to mention eastern part occupied by the Russians, had not one but three occupying powers. And these three powers, United States, Great Britain, France, had quite different constitutional traditions and ideas. This in itself worked against any idea simply to form the new constitution according to the special conception of any one of them. The Frankfurt documents issued by the military governments of the three powers entitled the prime ministers of the German states in 1948, 3 years after the end of the war, to start working on a constitution based, as these documents stated, on democratic principles, embodying the idea of federalism and also providing for an adequate central government, and finally guaranteeing fundamental rights and liberties. Now, of course, on these general principles, everyone could agree very easily. But of course, the details, how you did it, could make all the difference. And on these details, the Allied powers, the three Allied powers, had quite different conceptions. Carlo Schmitt, one of the leading German figures, Social Democrat, in the Constitutional Assembly, Parlamentarischer Rat, which formed the Basic Law of 1949, wrote about this. He describes the different attitude of the different powers and the representatives of the different power as following. The French representatives, he means, stressed above all the institute of federalism, this being considered to be an instrument to weaken the central power of Germany in order to protect France against the neighbor in the east. That was really all they cared about. The rest didn't mean too much for them. The Americans, he said, had the idea mainly along missionary lines. Anything good for America and the Americans would be good for Germany too. The British officials, however, generally had the opinion that the state perhaps should at best be established by the people who would finally have to live within it. So let the Germans make the choice for themselves. That was a British pragmatic, as all this British. Quite different from the situation in Japan, the new German constitution was not drafted by officials of the occupying powers, but by German parliamentarians sent into the Constitutional Assembly by the state's parliaments, which already existed. After a group of government officials worked on this in what has been become the deliberation in Herrn Chiemsee Entwurf. But this was apolitical, it was just government officials giving more or less alternatives and not deciding on special direction. Since the new constitution needed the final consent of the occupying powers to come into force, their wishes and ideas had to be taken into consideration. In general, however, I believe the influence of the three powers has been overestimated for a long time. The Basic Law of 1949 reflects the principal consensus of the German people on the needs and necessities of our time. It tries to derive answers from the bitter experiment of recent German history. It is, according to my own conviction and the opinion of most scholars, an excellent instrument and certainly the best constitution Germany ever had. It's quite obvious that many of the principles embodied in the United States Constitution are also part of the Basic Law. This indicates that during the debates in the Constitutional Assembly, the American Constitution was one of the more important sources of inspiration, perhaps more in the consciousness of the founders of the Constitution, every effort was made not to repeat the constructive faults of the Weimar Constitution, which contributed much to the failure of German democracy in the time between 1919 and 1933. Ironically, it was this recent German experiment which led the Parliamentary Council to reject the proposal to combine the position of President and Chancellor as in the United States. As Carlo Schmitt said, referring more to the Weimar time than to the situation in the United States, I quote Carlo Schmitt, such a vast power seduces men into abusing it, and power can be too easily misused if the head of state, who at the same time is chief executive, who cannot be overthrown, has at his disposal a well-integrated civil service trained to order and command. So much the quote by Carlo Schmitt. Of course, it can be doubted, and I doubt whether this describes the constitutional situation in the United States rightly. Recent discussions here might see a much greater risk in the situation of a president representing a global power with many international commitments who has, of course, all the trappings of his office, but perhaps has too little authority to conduct the foreign policy he feels to be in the best interest of his country. Completely different from the American concept of having foreign policy run more or less by the Congress, as expressly stated in the United States Constitution, under the German Basic Law, according to the jurisdiction of the Federal Constitutional Court, Parliament cannot interfere in the field of foreign policy, which, under the principle of separation of powers, is strictly the responsibility of the government and of the government alone. Only, of course, if a foreign treaty with a foreign country is concluded, a law consenting to this treaty has to be adopted by Parliament, giving its consent to this treaty. This example indicates, as but one example, the danger of, in a comparative analysis, simply looking at the institution, finds them more or less the same or similar, you might overlook the major differences which exist. A more detailed comparison, which I cannot take up now, would show many similarities of the American and the Western German constitutional system, as well as some major differences. This applies in particular to the concept of fundamental rights and the principle of judicial review. In particular, in these fields, German constitutional thinking owes much to the American example, even though here too the European continental experience goes much further back into the history. Traces of the principle of judicial review can be found in the Reichskammergericht, established, I believe, in 1495, which was just 3 years after they discovered this funny continent, which was later to be called America. But this, I believe, is perhaps somewhat besides the point. In trying to find out about the impact of the United States Constitution abroad, it is not enough, and perhaps does not help at all, to look at the text or to list up similarities or differences in the institution and in closing my address, I would finally again and for the last time quote Carl Friedrich, because my personal conclusion completely agrees with what he says, quoting him, particular features of a system of institutions torn from their context of living relations rarely function in the same way within the new context to which they have been transplanted. Hence, their impact is a curiously twisted and paradoxical one. The breadth of the Constitution's theoretical base, including its built-in contradiction, has facilitated the assimilation of particular features into radically different constitutional systems. Wherever men have gathered to draft a constitution, they have drawn upon American constitutional theory and practice. The attentive students of these constitutional debates is often forced to conclude that American constitutionalism's greatest impact occurred not by way of having American institutions taken over lock, stock and barrel, but by stimulating men into thinking out the various alternatives confronting them. I believe this is exactly the point which I also tried to make, and in this sense I feel the United States Constitution has indeed been and remains to be a gift to all nations. Thank you very much.
Who would like to raise the first question?
Back in 1972, our U.S. Supreme Court decided that it didn't allow the states choose to reinstitute it if they provided certain safeguards, such as a thorough review process. Virginia and a majority of her sister states have chosen in recent years to reinstitute capital punishment. And can you tell us something about how the West German Republic views this?
Well, it's very easy to answer, since in Article 102 of our basic law, of our constitution, death penalty has been abolished since 1949 and we don't have it anymore. So it's no problem. It's solved in the constitution itself. It's answered this question.
And what about, how does that affect extradition treaties, extradition arrangements?
This is a nice question. We had a case which was long before I joined the court in the late 50s or early 60s, in which somebody who was not a German, you can, according to the constitution, you can never deliver any German to any other country to have him before the criminal court. But it was a foreigner. He was looked for by French authorities, and some murder case or something like this. The French people at this time still had the death penalty. And as the case looked, there was a strong likelihood that there might be a death penalty. And after the competent courts decided to deliver him to the French, he filed a complaint of unconstitutionality, which he can do. Whether a German or a foreigner, he's entitled to, if he feels that any German state act violates one of his fundamental rights. And the state of act, of course, was a decision of the competent criminal court to deliver him to the French. German state act, he was submitted to it, and it was a possible infringement upon his constitutional rights. And the constitutional court decided that he could be extradited. This is, if you give me the time, I will, because it might be, you might have touched on an interesting principle difference in talking about in interpreting a completely different fundamental rights approach than you have here. And in comparing, if I might just spend a minute, because this has been one of the most famous quotes in our court's jurisdiction, it deals with the question whether we should stick to our principal decision not to have the death penalty or respect the French decision to have it. There's a conflict of values in countries which are both European countries with a similar cultural background, Christian convictions as principal value decisions and all this. And the court in this decision took pains to explain that the decision not to have capital punishment anymore and to respect human life, even in cases like this, much more than has been the tradition in some of the other European countries also here, is a direct consequence of the bitter experience of the Nazi time, which taught us that there is a point in which we have to do something to confront our past and take the consequences from it. And almost in the words, I don't have it here, of course, but I recall these words, that this does not reflect upon the similar value or different value decisions from other countries which did not have this bitter experience. This is almost a little quote in this decision. And this again was repeated in one decision I participated in, and in fact presided on, which was a famous abortion decision in 1975, in which we completely differed from Roe against Wade. And again quoted this and said, our stand in abortion, which is completely different, just the opposite from the American Supreme Court's decision, is some consequence, again, we took from the past, which did not respect human life. That is a very weak way of saying it, but I mean, you understand what I mean. Did not respect human life as much as it should. which leads us to arrive at different conclusions. This being, of course, not the only constitution argument, but one of the major principal constitutional argument. And this decision, we again quoted this former decision on the death penalty, which I mentioned. Now, this is of course, a unique approach to constitution, to a fundamental rights decision, which cannot be copied from any other country. It's unique because it's fallen from the special German experience, which explains some of the differences between, in similar cases, between the decisions we had and the United States Supreme Court made.
Yes. To what extent is the judiciary independent? How are the judges appointed? Does Parliament participate in the process? Their tenure? And yeah. Who controls their compensation?
Yeah. You mean judges in general or just the Constitutional Court?
The Constitutional Court.
Yes. But I might say this, just one sentence in general. Of course, they are serving for lifetime, which in our case never means until they die or decide to retire, but until, as the law stands now, until they are 65 years of age. It was a bit higher, 68 before, a couple of months with the highest civil and criminal court, but now it's generally 65 years, which does not mean to imply that after 65 years you are wouldn't be any good at all. Nobody should feel hurt by this. But I would believe it's a more pragmatic way of giving young people a chance to move in, because, like in this country, we have too many people passing law examination and leaving law school and trying to find a career in this field, and we should give them a chance. That's it. Now, the Federal Constitutional Court is, and I do it very briefly because it would be a completely new lecture if I go into it, very, very on the two major points in which it differs from the United States Supreme Court. First one, it's not part of the normal judicial system, but as the name says, it is a constitutional court which deals with constitutional questions only and has a virtual monopoly on all constitutional questions. No other court can find a law unconstitutional. Only the constitutional court. To explain this very short example, going back to your question, sir. In a murder case, a criminal court decided this is a clear-cut case of murder, but the obligatory life sentence, which is in murder cases, not in manslaughter, you can sentence them to a more or less limited term, murder case has to be for life. This would be unconstitutional, with similar arguments like the discussion about death penalty here. What they had to do is to stay their proceedings, bring the constitutional question whether the life sentence is in fact constitutional or not up to the constitutional court. I was on the court at this time, we discussed it and decided that it is constitutional, but told the legislature they had to make a provision to have the case reviewed after roughly 15 years, whether it still makes any sense to keep the convicted in prison, whether he's still dangerous to society, and all the questions which have importance in this question. Those are one of many other procedures. Main field, however, is a claim of unconstitutionality, which you can file against any state act, as I already mentioned, after having exhausted the existing legal remedies. So you have to go to the administrative court, civil court, criminal court, whatever the case may be, and after you're through and there is still a question of constitutionality, either of the law involved or of the state act, which then in reality and in most cases is a final decision of the highest competent court, then you file this claim has been done 60,000 times so far since 1951. Cases like of this sort coming in at the rate of 4,000 every year, year after year. And that's quite quite busy when you are on this court, similar to the workload of the Supreme Court. So this explains in some detail, it's a much longer story, the competence and the work of the Constitutional Court. Members of the court are not for life, 12 years only, no re-election possible. This explains why I served between 71 and 83. I didn't beat my wife or steal anything, or so they didn't kick me out for bad behavior, but it was according to the law that I, after my time was over, I had to retire gracefully with a good pension. It's not a question of kicking people out, and I was free to do something else, which I do now. And 12 years, justices are elected, half of them by a special committee of the federal parliament, which might fairly be compared with the judicial committee of the Senate, which is now conducting the hearings. A other half by the state's chamber, representing the state's government and the federal principal. In each one of these cases, you have to be elected by a two-thirds majority. Though a simple majority is not enough, which means in practical effect you need the consent of the major political parties, which probably would make it quite unlikely to have a discussion of the sort you have behind the Borg hearings. I mean, the principal question is he or she going to set up the balance of the court? I'm not discussing this particular case, it's not my business, but I mean, the principal question is an interesting one, of course. Since you have I come, as has been mentioned, from one of the political parties, I have been in parliament for a long time. I have been in politics, I have been known with my personal and political opinions, of course. But in order to be accepted by the other side, it's easy to be accepted by your own political friends, but you have to be accepted to the other people too who oppose you in the political fields. You have to be generally somewhat middle of the road. If anyone would come about who is under suspicion to topple the balance, he probably wouldn't have a chance from the beginning. And in fact, as it turned out, in all the time the court worked, which is now 40 years, roughly almost 40 years, I would say all the people, not all of them being politicians, that's an exception, me being the Chief Justice at this time was an exception. Yes, some particular obligation, of course, to represent the court and do all this, besides his judicial work, and has been some sort of tradition, has something out of the political field. Otherwise, these people are mainly professional high court justices. They have to be one third of them by law, and all the other, all university professors in the fields, in particular of constitutional law. Generally, there are people who are somewhat middle of the road. To be acceptable like this, and we also, if you want me to comment on this, we always had the experience, once you are with a court, it works quite differently from the political process. It's the very, I'm a bit confused by the very idea whether anyone, whoever he or she may be, would be perhaps willing, this might be, but would be able to turn the court around. It's certainly in our system it couldn't happen. Principle of continuity, even we don't have star decisive in all these principles, but principle of continuity, establishing a tradition, is much more important than anything else. And being a young court, you have to establish a tradition. That's why, like the United States being a fairly young country from a European point of view, just celebrating 750th birthday of my home city, Berlin. But I come from Spandau, which is 5 years older than Berlin. And keep telling people in Berlin that they are making so much fuss about these few years. Now, of course, 200 years is nice, but it's not very much. It's natural, and then it's just some by comparing what we do. When you are young, you try to establish tradition. You want to be adult as long as you are a kid. Once you are in a certain age, then you wish it would stay. But in your younger time, you still have the feeling you couldn't grow up fast enough. That's similar to this. So we respect tradition and jurisdiction. We never change our jurisdiction. Well, we do it, but we do it secretly. And I'm quite happy to find out that my colleagues the university didn't find out so far. Even though the big decision, but unless they are very clever, they will never find out.
Victor.
Dr. Bender, can the Chancellor in Germany pardon a criminal like he can in the United States?
Not the Chancellor, the President of the Republic. Yes, but the President would probably act on the recommendations not of the Chancellor, but of the either the state or the federal minister of justice. And it's depending on what case it is, it could also be a prime minister of one of the states. I don't have a president, of course. He minister president, head of the state government, he might be competent to give pardon, for instance, in a murder case. But if it is in one of the few federal crimes which are by the federal court, then the President of the Republic is competent to do this.
Okay, the federal constitution be amended by the government?
Not by the government, by legislature. And you need a two-thirds majority, both of the parliament, Bundestag, and of the state chamber. Two-thirds majority in each of them. And one nice particular feature of our basic law is that you are not supposed under Article 79, Section 3, you are not able to change two principles. Article 1, the principle of the obligation of the state not only to respect but to actively protect the human dignity. And the principle of Article 20, which means Federal Republic is to be a democratic republican, state to be and a federalist one under the rule of law, the social state under the rule of law, which is a nice and complicated question. What does it mean? But I mean, it's not just a loose notion. It has also Article 1 I mentioned have very real and concrete legal implications. But I don't have the time to explain this in detail. These cannot be changed. Not even by a revolution. Of course, now this is a nice idea for a constitution to believe by having it in the law. It's against the law. You can't people keep from doing so. This, of course, is not the idea. They have not been as naive as this, but they want to make it perfectly clear that anyone touches upon these principal decisions, this is going to be another state. It's not the same anymore. It changes the principal character. Of course, if something like this happens, well, it's a matter of who is better equipped to deal with it from a practical point of view. You can do it just by telling people it's against the law, against the Constitution. This wouldn't be enough.
Professor David Martin.
I know that your basic law has a somewhat more detailed listing of individual rights,
yeah,
a more detailed specification than we have in our own. And I wondered, from your perspective as a judge on the Constitutional Court, whether that's an advantage or a disadvantage as you try to approach cases. It may give you more specific guidance, but it may make it a little more difficult to maintain the evolutionary process that you referred to earlier in dealing with specific questions. And also, if you might, in the course of that, address one I know is somewhat controversial now, the right of political asylum as written into your constitution.
First part, I would say it is an advantage. We don't need to discuss, as you are discussing right now in the hearings I refer to, whether the freedom of speech clause includes anything outside of the strictly political field, like scientific writings or anything else, utterances of a scientific character or the arts or so, because it's expressly in the Constitution. Art and science and research are free. Article 5, Section 3 of the Basic Law. And that's all, they are free. Not free under certain conditions. Unconditionally, they are free. And while you can restrict freedom of speech by general law, for instance, the criminal statute, in defamation libel cases and so, of course you can do it. You can't do every by using your freedom of speech. You can't do everything, and the jurisdiction goes more or less along similar lines, like this famous Justice Holmes' clear and present danger doctrine and all this. So it is an adventure. I mean, I have one problem I don't have. You have. I don't have to define it, but perhaps you are right. It may not be a problem in the long run. Of course, we got enough points we argue about. And from a more professional point of view, some guy came about, and people in parliament keep, even though they make the law, always keep telling law should be clear, so everybody understands. And I tell them, are you crazy? We are all out of businesses. Everything is clear. We don't have lawyers and judges. To a certain degree, perhaps it's better to have them unclear. If not for this more not quite altruistic reasons, I would say just your point. Of course, if it is flexible, you can adapt to changing times. Now, I would still say in our system it's flexible enough, and many people believe, in particular in the field of politics, it's too flexible. We have, in principle, we have exactly the same conflict. Legislator making a law which acts out their convictions, majority decides, they feel they treated a given problem in a fair way. That's their conviction, I have to respect, but I'm afraid in this particular connection, it's for some constitutional reason, I feel it's unconstitutional. Now they have, of course, they have a detailed approach to a given problem. I answer them along more general lines of the phrasing of the Constitution, which is fairly broad, needs interpretation, and of course whoever has the power to interpret has the power to decide what is in it. Up to a certain degree, at least. And this is a principal problem of any constitution. And, well, you have to choose between this American constitution as a best example to have it in very general terms, which increases the danger of having what you call judicial activism, if you consider it to be a danger. You can argue about this, but I mean, which means more power to whichever court has competence to interpret the Constitution. Or you can do it in great detail, which means that you are somewhat inflexible. You have to change the Constitution very often, and which is a custom in some of the Eastern European countries, like Yugoslavia, for instance, which has, I believe, 450 articles in its constitution, and interestingly enough, for a communist state, has a constitutional court as well. even in the states, not only in the federal level, even on the states which I visited a couple of times. Interesting experience, not what we do, by no means, but fairly interesting to study because it's an effort to have at the same time a communist state, which means, of course, that the party decides the politics, not the court, certainly not. But to establish some sort of rule of law. Once the party is free to decide what they, how they want the affairs of state, and including also the, reflecting upon the average citizen, how they want it to be run. But once they say it's so and so, they have to respect what they decided upon. Interesting experiment. So something in between. We are leaning, if you compare these differences, we are far more close to the American constitutional principle of, in this respect, than to some of the others, which are much more detailed, including all the Italian constitution, for instance, Austrian to some extent. French is quite a different story again, fundamental rights field, and so on.
Professor Fernbach.
In our celebration of our 200th anniversary, we have given the impression, I think, to a lot of people that some very brilliant men sat down for several months in a very hot city called Philadelphia, and out of the blue thought of a marvelous document. Of course, behind that exercise with 150 years of colonial experience, much bitterness as a result of the revolution and so forth, it led the founding fathers to a concept of limited government, which is the fundamental aspect of the Constitution, and they wrote into it not only separation of powers, but also a system of checks and balances. I have found in talking with some Europeans that the concept of checks and balances is a puzzler for them. Would you care to comment on that?
It may be a puzzle to that extent, and this applies, in my opinion, to your system too, that the real principle of separation of power, as you find it in Montesquieu's teaching, has never been exercised in reality.
That's right.
And it's not an eternal concept. Because Montesquieu writes, for instance, that there is no freedom, to quote out of memory, not literally, but in the context what he means. There is no freedom unless judicial power is separated from legislative power. Neither you nor we separate judicial power from legislative power. In this sense, we do just the opposite. The idea is to have checks and balances. Our judicial power, I'm referring, of course, in particular to the Constitutional Court, and you do just the same, on one hand, checking on what legislative body does, whether I do it according to the Constitution. On the other hand, in your system, having advice and consent when the president appoints the justices, our case even electing in the system I try to describe, and having not for life but for 12 years, the very idea is of course to restrict. You have very great power in a real political sense once you are on the court, and you are not supposed to have it for eternity or as long as you live, but for a limited time. That's the idea of checks and balances. It can go on and go on. Might be the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, which is in particular a second Senate, which deals of question of state organization. I was always on the first Senate, which deals with question of fundamental rights. This jurisdiction is interesting to quote or to cite but one recent example. We had the heated discussion about the installation of Pershing II on German soil only a couple of years ago. And in Parliament, the opposition claims that under the Constitution, a major decision of this importance, it certainly is an important decision, has to be done by law. Now, it was not by, done by law, it was done by a government decision, and government invited the parliament to pass a resolution on it, but was not a law, and government claimed that they didn't need any consent of parliament at all. Now, this was this question was put before the Constitutional Court after it happened this way, claim being that parliament has to make a law. In this context, the Constitutional Court, which rejected the claim of unconstitutionality, referred to the principle of separation of power, meaning, again I quote from memory and at least in the tendency I believe correct, this sentence contained, or this judgment contained one sentence which to any American congressman or senator would seem extremely shocking. And explaining that the principle of separation of power means that the part of government should decide on a question which has a competence according to its organization and its general fitness to decide on a question, to decide this question. Meaning by this, which I believe to be true, that you cannot run foreign policy by arguing it in public among, in our case, 500 members of parliament. Now perhaps you can argue about this, but this is the idea, and of course it would be very shocking to any of the, it was very shocking to our, at least the members of our foreign policy committee who really, what they really do is traveling around the world, and, but they are firmly convinced they are great statement shaping the course of history, of course, and American senators, I guess, are even more so. And, well, that's not the idea. And it's a very practical consequence of the principle of separation of power. In this context, not invoking the principle of checks and balances. You could, of course, with the principle of checks and balances, you could argue it might not be a bad idea in foreign policy. The government, if it goes wrong, could be very dangerous. And perhaps you can even argue what you have fundamental rights against, protect you against everything. I'm not protected in my property rights if government decides to have an economic or social policy which renders my currency value lesser, and I lose everything I have, which happened in Germany, as you know, in the early 20s, and was one of the major reasons of the later historical developments. In some sense, it happened again after the Second War. That is a German experience. You cannot. I wouldn't know what to do about a ruinous economic policy under the fundamental rights concept, even though it destroys effectively whatever you have of fundamental rights. And in the field of foreign policy, of course, you can say, if this policy is foolish or dangerous and risky, it might lead to the loss of life of your citizens, getting involved in a war and anything of this sort. And again, after it happens, it's not certainly not easy to fight against this fundamental rights and going before a constitutional court. There might be arguments from the other side, but I just tell you what course of direction it took in our case.
I don't know if our most distinguished educator president has a final question. We had a tradition in this place, and it's time that we moved to a new figure. Duma Malone always asked the last question. It would be appropriate if he wanted it for President Shannon to ask the last question.
I think most of the things that I had in mind have already been well tested on. Surrender the last question to someone else.
Right. In the interest of people's lunches, maybe. We're terribly grateful that we've had this opportunity with Dr. Benda. It fits in, sir, so well with two previous lectures we've had on the Constitution of Poland and on the Constitution, Constitution of Japan, to which you referred. On October 30th, Professor Long will speak on the Constitution of China, interpreted in broadest way, include both Chinas, so-called, and then we will have a discussion with Professor Yun on the Constitution of Korea. However lively and informative and philosophical those discussions may be, it would be hard to imagine them being in any way superior to the discussions we've had today, and we can't thank you enough for your very informative and enlightening discussion.
Yeah, sometimes.